Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
It is 12:11, and here we sit in the Allstate Showcase studio on this Wednesday afternoon. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 396 points now. That's 1.6%. The NASDAQ down almost 1.5. So a rough day on Wall Street today. Let's talk about lunch instead. On a phone line is Ellie Hollander. She is the CEO of Meals on Wheels. Ellie, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks so much, Steve.
I'm glad you can talk to us because, the Meals on Wheels has almost become one of those things that that's always in the back of mind or a phrase that we use that maybe we don't actually aren't consciously thinking of. And so I thought we'd do a little bit about that today. How many meals do you guys serve a day?
Well, Meals on Wheels nationwide serves about 1 million meals daily, which is pretty impressive, isn't it?
It's pretty amazing. And are there geographic areas where you're busier than others?
Well, our programs serve across the nation, suburban, urban, rural. It's obviously a little bit more difficult to deliver meals in rural areas. But, the nice thing about Meals on Wheels programs is they're there for their local communities to try to meet the needs of their vulnerable seniors.
It's funny, and tell me if you've come across this, because honestly, Ellie, as I get ready to talk to you, the questions that I have are so basic because you think you know something about an organization, an institution that's always in your mind, and I really don't. I mean, do you think people sort of take you for granted and don't have an understanding of just what you're about?
I do. I think people out of sight, out of mind, and that's the whole issue of senior hunger and isolation. It's sort of a hidden epidemic. But Meals on Wheels, has been around for a long time. We're still here. We need help. We want to be able to make sure that our vulnerable seniors are able to live out their lives in their own homes longer. But as you said, people know the name, and they sometimes say, I don't hear from them much.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why we're doing this new campaign.
Okay, I hope this will be the last silly question I ask you, but where does the food come from?
Well, each program has a different approach. If it's a small program, they may actually have a local restaurant prepare the meals for them. In some cases, we serve upwards of 5,000 meals a day out of one program, and they may have a commercial-sized kitchen. So it's really very diverse and depends on the particular community and the needs of that community.
All right, this is a business show, and we talk a lot about the economy, the fact that we're almost at full employment. Things have been coming along swimmingly in the past several months. Do you find that your client base grows and shrinks with the economy?
Not so much, Steve.
Really?
Because
no.
Because the average recipient of Meals on Wheels, they're in their late 70s. So they're generally out of the workforce at this point, and they're on a fixed income. Many of the seniors that we're serving, are making daily trade-offs between paying their utilities, their rent, getting medications filled, or, getting a meal. So it's a kind of an older clientele, generally speaking. Now, where we do see a little bit of change, it's not so much employment, but sometimes people just need Meals on Wheels to help them through a transition, a health event, like mm-hmm. they're being discharged from a hospital, had hip replacement surgery, so they can't really stand or prepare their own meals. But for some seniors, it is the only way that they can remain independent in their own homes.
I guess I knew that you served older people, but I guess I assume maybe that their kids had the means to feed them when the economy was good, or that they could order out things like that. I really did think it would sway with the economy. I know their qualifications, right? How do you qualify to be eligible for Meals on Wheels?
Well, Meals on Wheels generally is focused on those in the greatest social and or economic need. And so, we really do determine whether or not a senior needs a helping hand, how, for how long, and whether or not they're the resources at that particular program to be able to support that. Some seniors are able to pay for their own meals, but many cannot. And many do have some economic struggles, as I mentioned earlier, making these daily trade-offs.
Oh.
So it's really trying to, prioritize, do we have enough meals to go around?
Yeah, well, don't worry about that. You can interrupt me anytime or keep going. But so there's value, obviously, in the nutrition of food, but there's great value, I would imagine, too, in just the human contact and the people who don't get out very much, to have someone come in and just to hear them talk for a while must be a great benefit to them.
Yeah, the issue of social isolation is so, so paramount. And we find that most of the seniors that we visit say they love the meal, but what means even more to them is the companionship, because they're lonely and isolated, and sometimes the Meals on Wheels representative or volunteer may be the only person that senior sees in a given day. So we always say we're more than just a meal.
And the population of the elderly is growing, right? Going to double by the year 2050. I would imagine that will put strains on your organization or challenges that probably you're working to address even now.
Right. I mean, definitely the future suggests that we are going to have more challenges. But even today, Steve, we're serving 19 million fewer meals than we were in 2005, just because the resources aren't keeping pace with need.
So so the need exceeds right now what you're able to do.
That's right.
And so what do people who are listening do to help that? I mean, there must be, is it strictly a volunteer shortage, or are you looking for food donations, or how is it that people can help?
Well, there are really three ways people can help, and I encourage people to go to the website AmericaLetsDoLunch.org, which is a site where people can volunteer, but they can also donate if they can't volunteer right now. And it will go to local programs where volunteers will be connected with their local program to volunteer. But you can also take action. And this is this program, Meals on Wheels, has been around for decades, and it's one of the few programs that's a great example of a successful public-private partnership. The federal government provides about 35% of the funding, and for every dollar the federal government puts in, programs are able to get a match in the state and local and private donations. So donations are also very important to this model.
You know, I would imagine people just assume Meals on Wheels exists everywhere, but if you're interested, you probably could start your own sort of chapter, right?
Well, I mean, I think if you have a need in your community and you're interested in entrepreneurial, you could certainly look into what it would take to create a nonprofit Meals on Wheels type program. And if the need's there, we encourage people to step up.
Ellie Hollander is the CEO of Meals on Wheels. All right, where do people find more information, or where do they go to volunteer?
Right, so go to AmericaLetsDoLunch.org, and you can just sign up right then and there.
Excellent. It was great to talk to you today. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It is now 12:22 as we're sitting here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 353 points so far on the day. Bill Geiger's in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Bill, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
Just talk to the audience for a minute. I'm going to check my 401k and see how I'm doing.
Yeah, you were
talking about me earlier this morning with Cochran, were you?
No, it wasn't me.
I'm listening to Geiger on with Cochran. He goes, yeah, there's one guy on the radio. He says when the markets are going up, he's always checking his 401k.
Well, I might have said that.
That might be me. And I haven't checked in the past couple of days because I don't think the news
would
be good.
You weren't supposed to be up that early.
You know, I'm always listening, yeah. Bill says, but that's not a great idea, is it?
No, it's not. It's exciting. It's fun. Who doesn't want to make money? But it kind of obscures a kind of a big issue we were talking about before going on air. We focus so much on how much money we have that we lose focus on some really big challenges we're going to face in retirement.
Tell me, what do you mean by that?
Excuse me. The biggest challenge, you know, we work primarily with people in their late 50s, couples in the late 50s, early 60s. And the biggest challenge that they face is when they sit down and start thinking about this, how are you going to pay your bills for the next 20, 25 years once you retire? I'm sitting down with a couple yesterday, and the wife says to me, she goes, when this guy stops working and he stops getting a salary, how am I going to pay the bills next month and the one after that and for the next 20, 25 years?
It's a very basic question, but I want to get to that. But along the same line, you know, people play with the retirement calculators. They'll go online and fill in the numbers. And, you know, I've done that. I don't know how helpful that is because
you're making some really big assumptions, like the last year, what your rate of return is going to be.
Exactly.
there are PhDs in quantum economics that can't answer that question.
But the point is, I'll focus on that to get to the big chunk, but have no idea really once I've got that chunk, how that chunk's going to be distributed to help me day to day.
Yeah, kind of in the back of people's minds is I want my stack of money to be as big as possible, and then I'm going to pick at it.
Right,
for the next 20 years, and cross my fingers and hope that it lasts. You know, we were talking about this also, that the happiest people we ever see come in are people with big pensions.
Right.
Because they know how they're going to pay their bills. They know how they're going to do this. Well, a lot of people don't know. You can use part of your 401k, and you can effectively create your own private pension plan. Which in some ways is even better than having a traditional pension. Traditional pension, you and your spouse are gone. There's nothing left. If you build your own private pension plan, when you're both gone, you've got an asset to leave on to your kids.
So how does that work? How do you set something up to where you are creating your own pension plan?
Well, most people have most of their money in a 401k. Excuse me. And when you're 59 and a half, a lot of people don't know this, but you can do something called an in-service, that means you're still working, rollover. In other words, you take the money that's in your 401k plan, you can pour it into an IRA, put the cup back underneath the 401k spigot, and keep going, keep contributing and everything. Well, with your money out of the 401k plan into an IRA, you can take part of it, and you can create a strategy that, as we were saying, effectively replicates a private pension plan for yourself.
Have you found, we were just talking about Meals on Wheels and the aging population.
Right.
When people come into you now, you're seeing different generations. Have you found now that more and more people coming in without traditional pensions, that they are more prepared or less prepared?
They're less prepared. The people with the pensions, it wasn't because they...
Because I would imagine the people coming to you right now were right on that cusp of, you know, their parents had the pension.
Exactly.
They didn't have to worry about retirement on their own.
And they don't, for the biggest part. Maybe 5% of the people come in and have a pension. You know, Steve, we haven't done this for a while. Let's do something special, especially in this topic we're talking about right now. The next five callers who call in who have at least $500,000 in their portfolio, we're going to sit down with them personally and help them put together a full-blown plan for their retirement, including an income plan, so they know how they're going to pay their bills.
Excellent, Bill Geiger. Great to see you again.
Good to see you, sir.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
It's 12:37 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. On a phone line is Ian Schur, senior editor at CNET.com, and joins us from time to time, usually most Thursdays. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well. I'm better than Mark Zuckerberg, I guess, right?
You are absolutely doing better than Mark Zuckerberg.
Okay.
Most of us are.
So I want to, well, I don't know if we, big picture, maybe not. We'll see. But I'm going to go through the sort of bit of it very quickly. You affirm or deny, and then we'll move on to the next subject, to talk to it a little more deeply. But here's, in my understanding, what happened. A guy sets up an app where people do these online surveys, and they do it. And when they sign up through Facebook, they agree to have their personal data in view of this guy creating the app. The guy who created the app then shared it with the data company run by Steve Bannon and others, contrary to Facebook's policies, correct?
Yes, that's all correct. And,
okay.
And the big scandal is that Facebook lost control of this data, not so much that this app developer got it.
Right, not that the other company got it, but that Facebook should have kept control of it. The other company then used it in elections and things like that. Okay, people say, well, wait a minute, Barack Obama, other politicians, they use all this Facebook data as well. It's really the same thing. My understanding is the difference is that when the Obama people got the data, they got it from people who willingly, who signed up through Facebook. So in a way, they knew what they were signing up for, whereas
correct.
In the other one, they don't, correct?
Yes,
okay.
Yes, you got it.
Okay. So all of that being said, that when we sign up for apps or anything like that, we kind of, if we're not very careful, unwillingly or willingly, I guess I should say, give up all our data, give up our friends lists and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, look, either you can claim ignorance and not knowing and not reading these long gobbledygook pages of legalese whenever you say okay, or you can blame Facebook for not making it more overtly obvious to you. But bottom line is that, yeah, a lot of us have been handing over the keys to our lives for a very long time now, willingly, right? We've all been pressing okay. And the bottom line is that part of it has come down to, you know, we are now dealing with a reckoning about how, you know, some of these people are not trustworthy. And they are taking our data and handing it over and selling it to other people. And this is just one of them, this Cambridge Analytica people. But there are more out there.
So one of the things
I
learned
underscores how bad this is.
One of the things I learned, Ian, is, you know, when you download a new app or a new software program or whatever, and they say, do you want to access it through a sign-in or do you want to access it through Facebook? A lot of times I'll say Facebook because, damn, it's just easier. I don't remember all these passwords. But when I do
that, we're all lazy.
If I access it through Facebook, that then gives this new app administrator access to my Facebook data.
Well, it can. So normally what happens now, and this has changed over the years, right? Part of what's going on is that Facebook is dealing with something that happened 3 years ago. But what happens nowadays is that when you log in through Facebook to an app or to a website, it'll say, hey, this website or app wants access to X, Y, and Z. They want your name, they want your friends, they want your location, and you can tell them yes or no on each of these.
Okay.
So, you know, we now have more control. But the problem is that there are still legacy things that happen, right? Facebook, up until 3 years ago, would hand over our entire list of friends, right? Every one of the 300 to 1,000 people you're connected with on Facebook could be handed over to these people by you pressing OK. And your friends never agreed. So a lot of this stuff is dealing with the kind of ghosts of Christmas past here.
And that has stopped, but there's still people out there who are under old agreements, you're saying. But that doesn't happen anymore.
The data is still out there. All of the agreements are over.
Another thing then, what's about this gauge that they say when you sign on to Facebook that you can look at the apps to which you've agreed to give your data?
Yeah, so we actually have an instruction on CNET where we have instructions for how you to figure out exactly which apps you've used and that you've logged in through Facebook, and you can take away their access. So I always do, personally, a little audit of myself every year or so.
So that's
at all the apps that I used on Twitter and Facebook, and I removed the ones that I didn't use.
But I thought I read something about they're putting up a new tool or a new gauge. Are you saying that's already up and available?
They are.
Oh, there's something
new
coming.
Well, no, it's existed for a long time, in fact. The FTC, when they went after Facebook something like 8 years ago, they required this type of thing. But it's very hard to use, which is why CNET has an explainer on it. But eventually, Facebook says they're going to make it a lot easier to use, and they're going to put it at the top of your newsfeed so you can't miss it.
All right, so Zuckerberg is doing his best to, you know, as mea culpa for all of this. And he said in an interview last night, you know, I'm not sure that Facebook shouldn't be regulated. Maybe we should.
Right.
It just has to be the right sort of regulation. What do you see coming out of this?
Without question, if I was a betting man, which I'm not, because if I was, I would really be on Wall Street. What I would say is that the Honest Ads Act, right, the law that's going through Congress right now, where internet companies have to follow the same rules as TV and radio, where when there's a political ad, it says, you know, I am so and so, and I approve this message. Those are by law. And that isn't being done online. And so I think Zuckerberg's going to say he supports that.
Okay.
In fact, he already did say he supports it. But I think he's going to draw a line in the sand very quickly. And he's going to try and avoid more regulation. And the problem is that the honeymoon between Silicon Valley and government is over. And it's not just the U.S. The U.K. government is coming after them. A bunch of other ones, too. And this is a real Pandora's box of trouble for them.
Okay, I get that whole political ad thing, but here's my issue with that. You know, if I see an online ad for J.B. Rauner or J.B. Pritzker or Bruce Rauner, the guys running for governor, you know, those are political ads. I get that. And so if they're going to be regulated on Facebook, okay, I get that. But what Cambridge Analytica and others are doing are putting these wedge stories in my news feed that aren't necessarily political ads, right? So that law is not going to help any of that.
Well, that's part of the problem, is that this is only a piece of the pie. And look, Facebook has not come up with a very compelling answer for how do we solve for the fake news? How do we solve for lying app developers? All these things, right? Facebook says that they're hiring more people to audit bad content and to weed out the really bad stuff. And they're hiring more people also to go after app developers. But, you know, we're talking about a network that has 2 billion people in it. You're never going to be able to hire enough people to get it all. There are larger questions.
Ian Schur is a senior editor at CNET.com. Go look at the stories we're talking about here and more. Ian, nice to talk to you. Let's do it again next week.
Absolutely. Take care.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing the news, providing input, and breaking down the stories that matter to the world of business. Earlier this week, the PitchBook released a study on the best cities for VC investments. And what do you know? Chicago tops the list for the best ROI. This continues with our underdog narrative because Chicago is 8th on the amount of capital invested in startups across the country. Don't worry, our time will come. Just keep on cruising, Chicago. And if you think your business needs a refresher, remember, there's always something going on at Score Chicago, like how to better your digital security. These days, it seems like there are major data breaches every month. So Score Chicago is holding a cybersecurity event on Monday, March 26th. Register today at chicago.score.org. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Here we are at 12:52 on the Wintrust Business Lunch, and I'm glad you're still here. I'm glad you didn't move, because apparently a lot of us are. The Tribune reported on a census study today showed Cook County lost 20,000 people last year. 20,000 people fewer in Cook County this year than there were in last year. Elise Glink is on a phone line. You know Elise from thinkglink.com, also the CEO of Best Money Moves, that HR app that helps workers deal with their stress and employers help the workers deal with their employers. How confusing was
exactly
that, Elise?
Right.
Oh, come on. That was not exactly right. It was close. You're not a Cook County resident, right?
No, I am. I live right in the on the upper edge, the northern edge of Cook County, and it's distressing to see the reduction in number of people.
As a booster of the Chicago area, I just want to thank you personally for sticking around. That's very nice of you.
thank you. We do what we can.
So it's 20,000 in Cook County, but if you look at the metro area, it's less than that. It's 13,286 fewer people in this year than there were last year. You want that number to be going up, I would imagine.
We do want it to be going up, and you actually saw a very positive change in 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, and it was in 2015, you know, well after we were done, or we thought we were done with the Great Recession, that we've started to see those numbers, you know, dive. And they've dived, you know, fairly significantly. You know, you're losing 13,000 people, you know, in the Chicago metropolitan area. It doesn't seem like a big number compared to, you know, 5 or 6 or 10 or 11 million, depending on how far out you go for the Chicago metro area. But you'd still rather see a gain than a loss.
And so is it? What do you do about it? I mean, is this reputation? Is this reality? I sometimes feel like we react to a reputation more than we definitely do to the facts we're facing. But Illinois has got some pretty troublesome facts that they're facing.
Illinois does, and it's scary. There are lots of reports, you know, anecdotally, of course, of people who say, well, the wealthiest citizens of Illinois, and most of whom live in Chicago or the metro area, are moving because of our tax situation, because of our pension situation, or because of the infighting that's been going on politically for quite a number of years. And it's hard to know if that's exactly right. We have also seen, on the other hand, you know, major companies that are looking at Illinois and in Chicago about moving their headquarters here, and some have moved their headquarters downtown. It's hard to know where it's gonna bottom out. I wonder, just because we don't know this officially, I just wonder how the crackdown on the immigrant populations, the fewer number of immigrants who are allowed to come to the U.S. overall and who would have settled in the U.S. in Chicago, how that affects this number as well.
That's an interesting question, because the number of people coming in has been dropping right over the past several years.
It has, and it's dropping very dramatically right now, especially from Latin American countries and the Middle East. And, you know, from a housing point of view, we've always said that immigrant populations are much more likely to buy a house faster than sort of native-born U.S. populations. And that's because it's very hard in many parts of the world, very hard to buy a house. And when you come to the U.S., this idea that you can own a piece of land and, you know, have build a house on it, build a life in it, that is actually something that is the cornerstone of the American dream. And immigrants come here with that burning inside them. And fewer immigrants means that that's not happening for as many people.
So, you know, actually, we haven't talked this week as much as I thought we would about Amazon. Oh, there's Jeff Bezos right there. No, I'm just kidding. About, you know, being in town to scout out locations for maybe HQ2. But when they see a report like this, it's not that it's going to make or break the Chicago area, but it's not an arrow in the quiver, is it? I mean, this is not a positive sign.
I think they'd rather see population growing, but in some respects, it's better for it not to be, you know, sky high and going crazy, and that's because you have housing costs that would also be sky high. Mm. Chicago's got a lot, and we have talked about this. Chicago has a lot of positives going for it when it comes to Amazon. We have a great employable base. We've got wonderful universities all the way down to the community college level that could give them the kind of employed workers that they need. They've got several distribution facilities here. We've got great transportation in and out, rail, airplane, you know, lots of highways, and we've got housing prices that are quite reasonable compared to the rest of the country. So for Amazon, I think it's a really strong case to come. Maybe this helps a little, maybe not, but I would point out that the tremendous growth of digital jobs in Chicago has just been a boon to both employment and housing, and we want to see more of that.
That's Elise Gling. Check out bestmoneymoves.com. Elise, great to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
You bet, Steve.